And thanks to the NPR team for that news. And now we're going to hear more of this talk by Howard Zinn, the historian, used to teach at Boston University and the author of many books, including A People's Guide to the United States, A People's History of the United States. And it's a classic, and we're going to start that second half of the speech in just a moment, so stick around here to 88.5 FM. We are fundraising for 2 days. We're doing a short fund drive, and we're hoping that you like the short fund drive. This is the way we power all the great programs that you look forward to, Democracy Now! And Midpoint and Radioactivity. We power the great programs, The Morning Show, The 60s Show, The Freak Show. We power these shows through your generous contributions. So please keep us on the air by making that donation today. Right now, it would really help because we have heard from 9 people in the last hour, not quite enough to reach the goal. Our goal was to hear from 30 people in the last hour. And now we've got the added problem of hearing 30 more people this hour. So we need 39 people to call us in the next hour. Let's thank some people. Rob Covington from Clearwater has made a $10 a month Circle of Friends donation. Says, keep up the great work. It's the best. I love you. I love all you do. I'm currently a Circle of Friends member, $10 a month, and I'm increasing that to $20 a month. So, Rob, thanks for your ongoing support.
That's great. Also, Norman Myers from Zephyr Hills is making a $10 donation. Norman says, great shows. Wish I could help more. So thank you for that donation. And now we're looking for your contribution. Can you support community radio in the Tampa Bay area with your donation by calling 813-238-8001 or by going to our secure website and donating at WMNF.org. We really need to hear from you. We need to know that there is support for this programming. Give us a call.
And if you've recently discovered WMNF and you've found your new favorite radio station here in the Tampa Bay area, maybe you found us and then traveled back home to New York or Virginia or North Carolina or California on your vacation here in Florida. We're glad you're listening to our app. Please, if you haven't yet made a contribution to WMNF, 70% of our budget comes from donors just like you, individuals out there who keep WMNF on the air and independent, so we don't have to go hat in hand begging to corporations and get money that may taint what we put on the air. So please make that contribution right now. We're going to hear more of this speech from Howard Zinn right now. And we need to hear from 39 people during this next hour as we fundraise here and try to keep WMNF going. And usually these fund drives work out. Usually we come close or go over the top and reach our goal. We're hoping today we'll reach our goal. Please make your contribution online at WMNF.org. You're not going to hear a terrific speech like the one we're listening to right now, the Howard Zinn speech, anywhere else. If you go to Orlando and if you go to Fort Pierce or go to West Palm Beach or Miami, speeches like this in Miami, they would storm the radio station, probably burn it down because we're playing a speech like this. So please make your contribution right now. And you know that we're proud to bring it. We've been bringing speeches by people like Howard Zinn since the 1980s. But we got to reach this goal. We are real short. We're 39 calls short this hour, but we have a whole hour to go. So let's hear more of Howard Zinn on 88.5 FM.
1 year after 9/11, President Bush announces, you know, the national security strategy. And this basically lays out the principles for American foreign policy and lays out the principles of unilateralism and the preemption and making sure that no power can rival the power of the United States in the world. Essentially, this is a declaration that the United States could ignore the UN Charter, because if you accept preemption, then you are violating the principle of the UN Charter that you're only supposed to make war in self-defense. And I suggest to you also violating the principles laid down in the Nuremberg trials, for which the Nazi leaders were put on trial and hanged, and that is for aggressive war. Preemptive war, that is war not in self-defense. So this is a very serious thing. This declaration of principles in the national security strategy. And we shouldn't think it was just a Bush Republican idea. You know, it's very often we like to think that before Bush, things were okay, and that Bush represents a dramatic departure from whatever we had before. But in fact, preemption is something that, after all, the United States has made war before, had invaded countries before, well, as we did in Southeast Asia, which was certainly not a matter of defending ourselves, you know. And the United States has done, made war unilaterally, this is before Bush, you know, made war unilaterally or carried out bombing missions unilaterally. I mean, sometimes creating a kind of cloak of internationalism by bringing in NATO or by bringing in the UN, as in Korea, but basically an American enterprise. And in fact, under Clinton, Madeleine Albright said at one point, some of you may remember this, she said, you know, we will, if possible, we will act in the world multilaterally. But if necessary, we will act unilaterally. So, and, you know, Clinton was not, you know, averse to acting unilaterally and preemptively. What happens in the present situation is that, I must say this, that very often liberals in the United States, people who are not for Bush, yes, liberals in the United States, accept with sort of qualifications here and there, but accept basically the Bush principles. The reason for this, I think, is that 9/11 had a very powerful psychological effect on everybody in America. But I think there are many people in the United States, liberal intellectuals, who are really, I think, so affected emotionally by what happened on 9/11 that I think it began to distort their thinking. I know they wouldn't like me saying this, distort their thinking about what was happening in the world and about America's role in the world. And they were sort of becoming hysterical over terrorism. And again, yes, there's a reality of terrorism, but there's a difference between dealing with terrorism in an intelligent and real way and becoming hysterical over terrorism in the way that actually liberals in the 1950s, and those of you who know some of the history of the United States in the 1950s during the Cold War period, during what is called the McCarthy period, you might remember that there were not just McCarthy people, but liberal people, Democrats, who reacted hysterically to what they considered the communist threat. I mean, to the point where Hubert Humphrey, who was a sort of a quintessential American political liberal, Hubert Humphrey suggested the notion of internment camps for dangerous people in the United States in times of crisis. And I think we're seeing, you know, something of the same phenomenon. Because I was reading in the liberal magazine, the American Prospect, with the editors in their recent issue, the premise is that the greatest immediate threat to our lives and liberties are Islamic terrorists with global reach. And therefore, when facing a substantial, immediate, and provable threat, the United States has both the right and the obligation to strike preemptively, and if need be, unilaterally against terrorists or states that support them. Preemptively, and if need be, unilaterally. Well, that is the Bush doctrine. And of course, they qualify this by saying, facing a substantial, immediate, and provable threat. The problem is that those who decide whether a threat is, in fact, substantial, immediate, provable. People who decide that will not be the liberal intellectuals who formulated this, but the people who run the government of the United States. They will decide it just as Bush decided it when he decided to go to war in Afghanistan and when he decided to go to war in Iraq. These ideas of unilateralism and preemption and these are not new. The whole history of the United States in the world is a history of expansion based on these and also rationales given, like the rationales given today when we go to war about spreading liberty and democracy and civilization. We declared war on Mexico in 1846 and again for the purpose of sort of teaching civilization to the Mexicans, and then we went into Cuba in 1898 to bring liberty to the Cubans. And in fact, there's always a certain measure of truth to these statements. That is, we did expel Spanish domination from Cuba. We liberated the Cubans from Spain, but not from ourselves. Because once Spain was gone, the United States moved in, corporations moved in, the American military moved in, rewrote the Cuban Constitution. But the rationale was, we are bringing freedom to the Cubans. And then, of course, going into the Philippines and bringing civilization, as McKinley said, Christianity, we will Christianize and civilize the Filipinos. Because we are different. We are better. There was at the time of the invasion of the Philippines, the American Secretary of War Elihu Root said, sort of a very classical statement of American exceptionalism. He said, "The American soldier is different from all other soldiers of all other countries since the world began. He is the advance guard of liberty and justice, of law and order, and of peace and happiness." The American soldier is different. Well, of course, now, right now, in the wake of Abu Ghraib, in the wake of all these revelations coming out every day about torture and atrocities and so on, doesn't sound right. But you might say, well, Root could not anticipate Abu Ghraib. But he didn't have to anticipate, because at the time he was saying this, the United States was already committing atrocities and massacres in the Philippines by these American soldiers who were different from soldiers, all over the world. The history of American expansion in the world is not a history which is taught very much in our schools or even in our colleges and universities. Because if young people in our schools learned the history of the United States expansion in the world, if they learned the history of the massacres and invasions that accompanied American expansion in the world, they could not possibly believe the President of the United States when he gets up before the nation and says, "We're going into this country for liberty and democracy. This is Operation Enduring Freedom," and so on. But that history is not there. And this misuse of history continues to be perpetuated by our political leaders, and not really caught or criticized by that part of the American culture which is supposed to check up on and criticize what the government does, that is the press, the media. I remember there was a point, I don't know, about a year ago, where the Mexican ambassador to the UN said something undiplomatic about the United States and Mexico. He said something about how the United States has been treating Mexico as its backyard. He was immediately reprimanded by Colin Powell, who said that this man did not understand the history of U.S.-Mexican relations. And in fact, he was soon removed from his post. That's how much clout we have. He was soon removed from his post as Mexican ambassador to the United Nations. So yes, without that history, you might actually believe Bush when he says in his recent inaugural address that it is, how did he put it, it is the sort of the mission of the United States to spread liberty around the world. Or say, as he put it, spreading liberty around the world, as he put it, is the calling of our time. And if you read the newspapers, including the so-called liberal press, the New York Times and the Washington Post, right after the Bush's inaugural address, you saw a flurry of praise for what Bush had said. The people were in the editorial rooms of these newspapers were so eager to hear those words about spreading liberty in the world, and as if everything else that has been reported from Iraq over the past 2 years is meaningless in the light of these beautiful words uttered by George Bush. But all I would have to do would be to just, with a very short memory, remember that a couple of days before Bush's inaugural address, a couple of days before that, there was a photo in the New York Times, which some of you may have seen, that showed an Iraqi girl crouching, bleeding, and according to the caption, she was screaming because her parents had just been shot to death by Americans firing on their car.
The speech is by historian Howard Zinn, who used to teach at Boston University, and this is WMNF in Tampa. The speech is called American Exceptionalism. It is from 2010 because he keeps referencing President Bush, but even 2 years after President Bush left, but it is an important speech, and it's always important to remember your history. That's what we do here at WMNF when we carry the alternative radio series. Oftentimes, it's about the history of some U.S. Government position or some foreign policy decision made by the U.S. government. So we're fundraising here at WMNF, trying to raise about $73,000 over 2 days. We started this morning. The morning show had a really good show of support. Right now, we're trying to raise money for public affairs and for programs like Radioactivity and for Midpoint and for Democracy Now! And for Alternative Radio, which we carry Tuesdays at 10 o'clock every other Tuesday. Sean and I are going to thank a bunch of people this hour. We hope to hear from 30 people, at least 30 people, maybe more. And thanks to Malcolm Morgan from Tampa, who just made a $50 contribution. He says, I've been listening for 40 years. I love Radioactivity, Midpoint, and Sunday Simca, writes Malcolm. Malcolm, thank you very much for a nice contribution. Paul from Clearwater just made a $50 contribution. Paul, thank you for that. He says, a suggestion, it would be nice if you had Venmo, PayPal, or some other form of payment option. So that's a good suggestion. We'll pass it on to Laura, who is our development director. John Maddox from Apollo Beach just made an $88.50 donation. He's taking a WMNF T-shirt. Thank you, Paul and John, for that. And Carl and Nancy Wagonfour from Tarpon Springs made a $63 donation. They're taking the WMNF face mask.
And Rob, I'd like to thank Kim O'Connor with a $10 contribution. She's enjoying the talk here in Tallahassee and enjoying everyone at WMNF, so thank you for that. Also, Marsha Downing, $25 contribution, loves the programming. Thank you. Karen from Lakeland, $126 donation. Thank you for that. Says AR, Alternative Radio is excellent. Ronald and Maureen Kuntz from Plant City, $180 contribution. They're getting the Crank Radio flashlight with the USB port to charge their devices. They love all of public affairs programming. They listen every day. Thank you. We have a new member, Anonymous from Gulfport. Thank you for this Gulfport donation for a $10 circle of friends, and says that WMNF has been the voice of reason and sanity since I moved to Florida. I'm beyond grateful for your thoughtful and entertaining programming. Thank you. Also, Anonymous from Lithia is joining the Circle of Friends at $5 a month. Rob, do you have anyone else?
Yeah, thanks to Jeff in Tampa for that nice contribution of $60. I looked at his name, and he's one of the regular emailers. Thank you, Jeff. And we'd like to hear if you're a regular emailer or caller. Please call us at 813-238-8001. Make that contribution. And thanks to Eric, who's in Tampa. Thank you for that nice $50 contribution. Anonymous in Tampa just made an $88.50 donation. Thank you, Anonymous. And Twinkle Yoakum from Bowling Green, Florida, made a $20 contribution. Twinkle, thank you. She loves alternative radio. She's sorry it's on only every 2 weeks. So we're going to hear more of this speech right now. Sean, I just did the numbers. We're about 30 calls away this hour from reaching the goal because we just caught the we finally raised 30 for the last hour, so now we got 30 more to go.
That's great. It's an ongoing process, and we can do it with your support by calling 813-238-8001. I'd like to thank Jim and Rosemary Tantalo from Sarasota with their $25 contribution. Thank you for that. Also, Anonymous from Newport Richie is donating $10, and thank you. Theodore Harvey from Brandon has contributed $20. Loves Radioactivity with Rob Lori. If you like these programs, the Radioactivity is the time slot that we're listening to right now. Rob brings in great guests and interviews them and has awesome call-ins from participation from members of the community. Support that by calling 813-238-8001.
Yeah, Sean, I try to bring in guests, local guests talking about local issues and national guests talking about some of the national issues. And I stretch far and wide. Sometimes you'll see the guests that I have on this radio program, Radioactivity. Sometimes you'll see them the following week on some of the cable shows, and I'm happy to do it. And we always, if we have time, open up the phone lines and take comments from listeners about the issues raised on the program. And today we're doing something a little bit different. We're fundraising mostly around this speech by Howard Zinn, and we're gonna go back to it in just a moment. We are 30 calls away from reaching the goal this hour. I think we can do it. Mm-hmm. I see two lines lit. If we got a $1,000 donation right now, that would be a big help. But if you like Radioactivity, and if you like hearing all the various guests that I put on this program, plus you hear Floored this week on Mondays, and you always hear a lot of comments from listeners. I try to be mostly in the background, let the listeners talk, and really give their opinions. Please keep this radio show on the air by calling 813-238-8001. There is no radio show like it in the Tampa Bay area. You can go to AM, you can go to FM, but there's nothing like it that has the high mix of listener input and the high mix of quality guests. So please keep Radioactivity on the air. And if you like Midpoint, if you like the morning show, if you like It's the Music in the Afternoon or the Traffic Jam, it's an all good reasons to donate to WMNF. We hope you donate now. Please call us and keep the show on the air by calling 813-238-8001. Well, it's always important to hear history, so we're going to go back and hear more history from the great historian Howard Zinn. Here it is. American Exceptionalism, the speech by Howard Zinn.
Of course, you know, there's always, well, we claim the military, we'll investigate. Oh, there were warning shots. How do you distinguish a warning shot from a shot? But in any case, remarkable juxtaposition of, but also a testament to the loss of memory, even a memory that can last a couple of days, to see this eager acceptance of Bush's words about liberty. And this idea of American exceptionalism, what this idea of special American dispensation in the world, what it leads to is an abrogation of all sorts of responsibilities to the human race, to everybody else in the world. And it means that the United States is exempt from these responsibilities. I told you about Madeleine Albright declaring that we have a right, if necessary, to be unilateral. When she said that, Henry Kissinger said, this principle of our right to take unilateral action, he said, should not be universalized. That's an interesting thought. It's a good principle for us, but no, it shouldn't be universalized. No. And so there are all there's a long list of instances in which the United States has declared itself exempt from a sort of international agreements and international laws and the UN Charter and the Convention on Biological Weapons, which was actually signed some years ago, but which didn't have any teeth, didn't have any force. And when it was proposed to enforce this Convention on Biological Weapons a few years ago, the Bush administration said, no way, it wouldn't go along with that. And I think most of us know the United States has not gone along with the 100 or more nations that have outlawed landmines. What's the answer to this very dangerous notion of American exceptionalism, of our right to do as we will in the world? Well, I guess the answer is sort of obvious, and that the answer is that those of us in the United States and in the world who don't accept this idea must declare very forcibly and act very vigorously against this idea and insist that ethical norms that most decent people can agree on should be observed, and that no country should be an exception to the rules of morality in world affairs, and that the children of the world should all be seen as part of a family, and that the children of Iraq or the children of China or the children of anywhere in the world have the same right to life as American children. I mean, those are very fundamental moral principles, which if our government doesn't uphold them, we must uphold them. Fortunately, there are people all over the world who want to uphold those principles and who oppose it when the United States does not. And we saw, on February 15th, 2003, on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, we saw that amazing moment when on one day, 10 to 15 million people around the world, in 60, 70 countries around the world demonstrated against that war. So there are people all over the world who do not accept the idea of American exceptionalism. When last week the State Department issued its report on human rights abuses, it does this every year. It lists countries which are guilty of torture and other abuses of human rights. And so it lists a bunch of countries. A number of those countries are countries which are allies of the United States. A number of those are countries to which the United States has sent prisoners. And, I think by now that this notion of extraordinary rendition, where we're not going to torture these people, we'll send them to countries which will torture them. And so the State Department issues this list of countries which have violated human rights. And then when the report came out, there were responses from around the world which said, hey, there's one country which is missing from this list. And yes, what about the United States? A Turkish newspaper said, there's not even a mention of the incidents in Abu Ghraib prison, no mention of Guantanamo. A newspaper in Sydney, Australia, pointed out that the United States sends suspects. Remember, suspects are not people who've been tried and found guilty of anything, just people who are suspected of doing something. Send suspects to prisons in Morocco, Egypt, Libya, Uzbekistan, countries that the State Department says uses torture. And so people around the world, yes, and here in the United States, this is something that we very often are deprived of. We're not only deprived of history, we're very often deprived of immediate history. That is, we're deprived of things that happen in this country that people are doing that we don't know about, because this is a big country, but that would be an easy excuse, that we're a big country and that's why we don't know about them. No, we don't know about these things that are happening around the country, these protests, these declarations of humanity. We don't know about them because they're not really reported. If you go to the internet, you might find out. If you go to a rally, you might get some of this information. If you travel around the country, you might learn that, you know, this coming weekend there will be demonstrations in cities all over the country. There's going to be a demonstration in New Orleans. There's going to be a demonstration in Fayetteville, North Carolina. There's a resistance movement in the United States to this war. And you see only the superficial, you might say, recognition of this when you read public opinion polls, which show that now about half the country does not believe in the war. And if half the country does not believe in the war, then somewhere among that 50%, there must be many, many people who are actively opposing that war. And those people are in fact, engaged in protest all over the United States. And what's perhaps most significant is that in the armed forces and in the families of the armed forces, there is more and more defection from this war. The Iraqi veterans against the war formed in kind of a reprise of what we had during Vietnam veterans against the war. And we have military families speak out, of the families of soldiers organizing and who now have thousands of members. And GIs themselves, GIs in the field, and you read about instances of mutiny, and GIs who say we don't want to, who've been to Iraq, who are being sent back, who don't want to go back, and some of them go to Canada, and some of them get court-martialed. This is important because I think of what Einstein said when, at the end of, after World War I, horrified by that war and by the idea of war itself and by the knowledge that now modern warfare would be indiscriminate and massive. And Einstein said, wars will stop when men refuse to fight. And so the refusal to fight and refusal of families to let their kids fight, and the insistence of the parents of high school kids that they will not let recruiters come into the high schools and approach their kids, all of these things are consistent with what Einstein thought was ultimately the way that wars would stop. So I leave you with the idea that we're not alone, and that there are people all over the world and people in this country who do not accept the idea of a special dispensation to do whatever we want in the world, and who will insist on human equality of people everywhere. I think of William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist. I think of what was on the masthead of his anti-slavery newspaper, The Liberator. On his masthead were the words, "My country is the world. My countrymen are mankind." A good thing to remember. Thank you.
That was Howard Zinn.
That's the voice of David Barsamian, who produces these programs. This is a speech that Howard gave in 2010, and we've heard it. It's called American Exceptionalism. We've heard the whole speech. We started playing it more than an hour ago. Hope you enjoyed it, and hope that you feel like it's important to support a radio station that doesn't talk down to you, that brings you terrific people like Howard Zinn, and is not afraid to play an hour-long speech by him. And we are certainly brave enough to do that. We've been doing it for more than 30 years. Jerry Spiller from Englewood just made a $20 contribution. Jerry, thank you very much. And Scott Houston is helping us stay on the air with his contribution of $100. He's taking the WMNF face mask. Thank you very much. He loves alternative radio, especially with Chris Hedges, and likes Richard Wolf too. Peter Dalikos, who's one of those people who's trying to save the environment in Tarpon Springs, just made a $25 donation. Thank you very much, Peter D. from Tarpon. And Anonymous just made a donation of $26 from St. Petersburg. Thank you, Anonymous. Loves the Howard Zinn speech. Well, if you like the Howard Zinn speech and want to support the radio station that dares to bring you a speech like this, please make that contribution now. Sean, I think we're 27 calls away from reaching the goal for this hour.
Okay, that's great. Well, here's David Rusinak, from St. Petersburg with a $100 contribution. He says, I don't necessarily agree with all of the public affairs shows, but WMNF provides a bit of sanity to the airwaves. So thank you for that $100 contribution. Also, we have an anonymous donor from St. Petersburg contributing $35, says, everything is magical now, working from home, listening all day to WMNF. That's great. Also, Julia Bartunek from Newport Richie is contributing $30, says, Sasha loves Radioactivity and all the callers. So thank you for those contributions. Now we'd like to hear from you, 813-238-8001 or WMNF.org, or hit the WMNF app, hit the tip jar there, and make your contribution to community radio.
And if you like the interviews that you usually hear on Radioactivity, this time of day, normally we'd carry an interview and then open up the phone lines. Please let us know that you like the interviews that you hear on my program, Radioactivity. I couldn't do it without your support. Without your support, this radio station and my program and all the other programs would go away. So please make that contribution now. Please go to your phone, 813-238-8001. We're about 27 calls away from reaching the goal for this hour. That's really good. We just need a few more phone calls, and we'd like to see one phone line lit. Remember, when Howard Zinn was alive, he was actually a guest on Radioactivity. That goes years and years ago, back to the 1980s, when he was in town and the U.S. covert wars in Central America were going on, and Howard graciously was on this program. But we try to get some of the best speakers in the world on this program, and we hope that you make that contribution. I'm looking at the phones, Sean. Nobody's calling. Let's see if we can get one more phone call here at 813-238-8001. Remember, for a donation of $180, it turns out it's $180, we'll give you the WMNF hand-cranked flashlight radio. You'll be able to get through the next disaster if your power goes out. This will be able to crank your phone and also link you to WMNF and all the radio stations. We've also got the WMNF Peace Magnet for a $60 contribution. We have the WMNF Face Mask for a $60 contribution, the MNF Ball Cap for an $88.50 donation. Sean, I want to play this interview with Benjamin Carter Hett, who wrote a book called The Death of Democracy. It's how the Nazis came to power in the 1930s and 40s, and it has some parallels for our time. Yeah. So I want to play that. But Sean, look at the phones, and nobody's calling at 813-238-8001. So if you're a fan of Radioactivity, I really need your help right now. If you appreciate the fact that it is not just a one-way conversation where we talk at you, but also you are able to call in and comment about the topics that are raised on this program, please keep it on the air by calling 813-238-8001. I don't think any radio station has as many local callers calling in. And some of our callers are really some of the smartest people in all of the Tampa Bay area. So please call us at 813-238-8001.
Rob, I'd like to thank Beverly Capshaw with a $63 contribution from Tampa. Bev says, Rob and Sean, I'm making this donation in honor of my cousin, Walter Seward. Walter served in the Marine Corps and was currently serving as a bus driver for Hillsborough County School System, bus 5654. He died of COVID last week. I'm so sorry to hear that. Oh. Walter was 63 years old. How tragic that Governor DeSantis will not prioritize public school employees over his political ambition are the words from Bev. Thank you for that contribution. Very sorry for your loss, Bev. 813-238-8001.
Yeah, very sorry to hear that. Well, let's listen to an interview that David Barsamian did with Benjamin Hett, who wrote the book Death of Democracy about the rise of Nazism in Germany in the 1930s and how they came to power using, in part, democratic means. And there are parallels for us. So please support the radio station that brings you these important interviews and speeches. Here is Benjamin Hett being interviewed by David Barsamian.
the origins of the Nazi Party. You write the National Socialist German Workers' Party emerged from the German Workers' Party that was formed in 1919. It was a French party, you write, until the late 1920s when it began to win significant support, first in Protestant rural areas. When Hitler took over as the party's leader in 1920, he added National Socialist to its name.
One thing this shows, I think, is the political cleverness of Hitler. The DAP, the German Workers' Party, was just another of any number of radical right-wing fringe movements that were springing up in Munich right after the war in 1919. And the DAP would have gone nowhere at all if Hitler, on one occasion when he was working as kind of a political spy for the army, hadn't wandered into one of their meetings and been incensed by a speaker who advocated Bavarian secession from Germany. And Hitler rose and poured a torrent of abuse on this man, as only Hitler could. And this impressed the heck out of the other people in the DAP. The man who had founded the DAP, a man named Anton Drexler, heard Hitler speak, and he said, that guy's got a mouth on him. We could use him. And so they tried to sort of draw Hitler into their party to be their speaker, which, of course, they succeeded at. And then about 6 months later, under Hitler's leadership, they reformulated the party as not the DAP, but the NSDAP, National Socialist German Workers' Party. That National Socialist is interesting because in conventional political terms, certainly at that time, that should have been a total oxymoron. Because national implying nationalist, on the one hand, and socialist, which is conventionally thought of as an internationalist ideology. So a national socialism should be an oxymoron, but it was Hitler's cleverness to see how this could be a kind of political marketing pitch, how you could basically present not actually a socialism in Marxist terms, but a kind of egalitarianism that was also nationalist, and that might be a potent electoral appeal, which it took a while to catch on, but that turned out to be right.
You write that the Nazis were able to win a significant support, first in Protestant rural areas. Why Protestant rural areas?
This is an interesting fact about German politics in this era, and I think this is something that's probably not really widely known. As often happens in politics, there was a constituency that could be a natural constituency for the Nazi message, and then there were other constituencies that were not. There were basically three blocks in German political society: the socialist working class bloc, there was the Catholic bloc, and then there was a slightly more amorphous group, which we might call the Protestant middle class bloc. Even when the Nazis started to do really well in electoral appeal after 1928-29, they never made really deep inroads into either the socialist working classes or the Catholic constituency, where they really not only made inroads, but basically took over this segment of the voting public, was with what we would call the Protestant middle class camp. The reasons for that is what it was the Nazis were really offering. We tend to think of them now as being primarily anti-Semitic and perhaps primarily or secondarily militaristic. But neither of those notions were at the forefront of Nazi campaigning when they started to attract support. What the Nazis really were in the late 20s and early 30s, in terms of their messages to voters and in terms of which voters caught that message and responded to it, they were an anti-globalist protest movement. And this goes a long way to explaining why it is that they were able to capture Protestant votes, particularly in rural areas, because this was a time in which across the sort of north and east of Germany, the agricultural heartland, so to speak, that region was being really hit by trends in the global economy at the time, notably a dramatic drop in world grain prices, so that it was becoming very difficult to make a living farming, and rural areas were really hit by this and were experiencing a lot of poverty, which led to a lot of protest and a lot of anger at the Democratic Republic, which people thought was responsible for this situation, and a lot of anger at broader forces in the global economy and trade and so on, which seemed to be bringing this on. And the Nazis really positioned themselves as nationalists and against global trade, and they certainly positioned themselves as burningly hostile to the Democratic Republic. And it's fascinating that we see these messages really starting to resonate in these Protestant rural areas where even before the Nazis achieved a real breakthrough in a national election, which was 1930, but already in 1928, 1929, they're starting to do a lot better in state elections by capturing this rural Protestant vote.
And you write that religious belief was a huge component of rural identity. For German Protestants, the male-centered family was the core of the social order. And then you add that the Weimar Republic concentrated in one package everything Protestants didn't like.
There's, I think, a sort of interesting parallel here to things that we're all familiar with. This is one way in which Weimar Germany looks quite familiar. There was a kind of culture war with a strong religious component. A lot of Protestants, particularly Protestants in rural areas, strongly disliked several things which seemed to be characteristic of the new era of the 1920s. They disliked the life of big cities. They disliked all of the sort of cultural things that seemed to go with that. Sexual experimentation, changes in gender roles, a sort of drift away from the church. They disliked the political prominence of the urban working classes manifested in social democratic influence in the New Republic. And also they tended to see it as too Jewish because they tended to equate, in a sort of general way, all of these modern trends to political democracy, to individual rights and so on, a lot of modern art of the time. They tended to think, well, this is all actually really Jewish. So they thought, Weimar is too Jewish, it's too Catholic, it's too urban, it's too Berlin, because all of these modern things were very much centered in Berlin. And here, too, the Nazis were able to really play to that and say, we're the party that's against all this. Here is where Nazi anti-Semitism, a little bit in a dog whistle form, played a role. They positioned themselves as against all the sort of modern artistic experimentation, gender experimentation, and so on that seemed to be characteristic of Berlin in that area, and that era, and that, too, tended to consolidate their support in exactly those groups where they were doing well. Anyway, the sort of Protestant rural and Protestant middle class constituency.
And in terms of the Weimar Republic, what is its structure politically?
Yeah, so the Weimar Republic is the sort of informal name we give to the state that gets formed out of that revolution that comes at the end of World War I, where basically the Social Democrats take over. And then early in 1919, the Social Democrats had a very clear idea of what they wanted to do. They wanted to have national elections for a constituent assembly that would draft a new constitution. They had these elections in January. The Social Democrats won them in the sense that they got the biggest vote share. They didn't get a majority on their own, but with particularly two other democratic parties, the Catholic Center and the left liberal German Democrats, these three together had a very big majority. So they created this highly democratic political system, this new constitution. And the new constitution came into effect in August 1919. It also had built into it some things which would turn out to be problematic, which the framers didn't foresee. These really revolve around the power of the presidency. So the office of the presidency was separate from the parliament, or the Reichstag. So the president was separately elected by the whole people for a different term. The parliamentary term was 4 years, the presidential term was 7 years. And very fatefully, the president was equipped with emergency powers under Article 48 of the Constitution, probably the most famous part of this Constitution, so that in an emergency, the president could do by decree pretty much anything he wanted. This created the possibility that the president might be able to function as a dictator, issuing these decrees. Now, the framers didn't think this was a problem because it didn't really occur to them that an opponent of democracy might get elected to the presidency of a democracy. I think you can't blame them for maybe not thinking that that was a possibility, for that not having occurred to them. But in fact, that's pretty much precisely what happened in 1925 when the World War I commander, Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg, in a real squeaker of an election, got elected to the presidency. And that then created the condition where you have a man who really is someone who doesn't like the democratic system occupying the very powerful office of the presidency and with access to these emergency powers. That creates one of the ground conditions which then in a few years' time makes it possible for the democracy to really go down the drain.
Talk about the rise of Hitler, the failed push in Munich in 1923. And what class of people, if one could generalize, did the Nazi movement attract?
At the beginning, Hitler was a very, very unlikely person to follow a successful path in German politics. German politicians generally, and this is true even of people from the working class parties like the Social Democrats, they tended to be well-educated, politically thoughtful, well-read. Hitler was very much a horse of a different color. He had fought in the German army in World War I, but he had very little going for him. He had no family name, no money, you know, very little formal education behind him. What he did have, as it turned out, as we know, is a remarkable talent as a public speaker. He also had some slightly less visible talents. He had a remarkable ability to perceive what people thought and felt and wanted to hear, both on an individual basis and when dealing with crowds. He was very, very politically cunning, and he had very strong nerves. He was able to sort of wait for a moment to strike when people around him often were saying, "We've got to do something now," and he would have the sort of gambler's nerve to hold out.
Well, that's New York University professor Benjamin Carter Hett, who wrote several books about the rise of Hitler. One of his most recent books is a classic. It's called The Death of Democracy, and if you haven't read it, you should. That's an interview that David Barsamian did, and if you enjoy the good interviews that we carry here on WMNF, we hope you'll make a contribution to help keep this radio station on the air. No other radio station in Florida is doing what WMNF does, so we hope you'll keep this one on the air. Please call us at 813-238-8001. We've got incredible programs here on WMNF and also on our HD3 channel. Sean Cannon is here. A few minutes ago, we needed 24 more phone calls. Sean, do you have anybody to thank?
I do. Charles Kilboy from St. Petersburg is donating $60 to get the WMNF face mask and says, "Keep up the good work." So thank you for that. And we can with your donations at 813-238-8001.
All right. So, Sean, we only need to hear from about 20 more people. Thanks to Chris Markin from Tampa. Just made a $120 contribution, joining the Circle of Friends at $10 a month, and loves Mark Bureau's show, and he's pledging for radioactivity, too. Thank you. Thanks to Anonymous from St. Pete Beach for a $100 contribution. Anonymous says, "Joanne and John in Nova Scotia listen every day, especially to Radioactivity. It's one of their favorites. Thank you, Joanne and John." And thanks to the person who made a $65 donation, Jim from Pasadena, Maryland, loves Democracy Now! And loves Howard Zinn. That's great. Mm-hmm. We're getting a lot closer. Thanks to Project Carr, joining the Circle of Friends at $10.50 a month. Love the show. Keep up the good work, they say. And Paulo Albuquerque and Doris Nerito just made a $60 contribution. Thank you very much. Radioactivity and the public affairs shows. And thanks to Elizabeth in Spring Hill for a $10 contribution. Thank you, Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. Sean, we are getting a whole lot closer. If you love listening to good interviews, please make that contribution now. We're still... Let me kind of calculate this. I think we're about 20 calls away from reaching the goal.
That means we need to hear from you. If you're a fan of Radioactivity, every single weekday morning at 11, Rob brings on great guests. And a couple, I think it was 5 years ago or 4 years ago, he interviewed Joe Biden, right?
Joe Biden was on just before the last presidential campaign, not the 2020, but the 2016.
Yeah. And so he brings on great guests and super terrific interviews, and it's worth supporting. 813-238-8001. You can donate on our tip jar at the WMNF app, or you can go to our secure website, wmnf.org, and show your support for Radioactivity, Rob's great interview show.
And if you make a donation now, I'll tell you how to get access to that entire interview with Benjamin Hett. It's really an incredible interview, but please call us. We are in dangerous times right now. There are rising groups of fascists who were there at the U.S. Capitol just a few days ago trying to overtake the the government, trying to storm the building and shut down the count of the electoral vote. These are dangerous times. We're not out of the woods yet, and those groups are still brewing. There are talk radio stations all over the country that are encouraging that kind of activism, if you will. So please help this one radio station. It's the one that really stands up and stands for a sense of history and a sense of facts, and it stands up for grassroots activists that don't want to turn our country into a fascist state. Please call us at 813-238-8001. There's still time. Sean, we haven't had a call here in the last few minutes.
That's shocking, because this is such a great show. It's worth supporting. Can you make a $50 donation to 813-238-8001 or on our website, WMNF.org? Support Rob, support Radioactivity, support the whole community radio station.
Well, please help us out. We're the community radio station here in the Tampa Bay area. Please call us at 813-238-8001 and make that donation. This is WMNF in Tampa. Your hero, Mark Biro, is next right after the news.